PCJ Radio International presents the longest-running international show, The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehon.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to another edition of your program, Happy Station from PCJ Radio International. Today our show is titled The Candelabria. Ah, you're thinking, wait a second. What, Liberace's in the studio with you? No. Well, he is, and he isn't. We, of course, have been finding some tapes of some interviews that Tom Meyer did between 1970 and 1992 when he hosted this program, and we've been using a lot of them today. Because they're absolutely fantastic, and we can, you know, kind of update what's been going on with that artist since that interview was done. Some artists are with us, some are not, and of course Liberace is not with us today, but his influence is still going on. We're going to be joined on the phone in a moment by Jonathan Warren from the Liberace Foundation. He's the chairman of the organization. But first, let's begin with Tchaikovsky's Concerto No. 1, something that was well connected with Lee for the many years that he was touring. Liberace playing Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto number one. Now, I should tell you, having seen Liberace perform live, seeing him perform in front of an audience with a full orchestra is very different from listening to him on record. We will have a couple of live, one live performance coming up with something that became also very well connected with him. But we'll listen to that a little towards the end of the program. The Liberace Foundation. Yes, the Liberace Foundation, of course, was started many years ago to protect the memory of Liberace. Not just the memory, but also all the items that he had, which were absolutely fantastic. Jonathan Warren is the chairman of the Liberace Foundation. And in the interview that we did this week, we talked about the man himself and also about the work of the Liberace Foundation, which you can find at liberace.org. Jonathan Warren is with the Liberace Foundation, and we sent him a copy of an interview that Tom Meyer did with Liberace when he was in Amsterdam in the early 1980s. And Jonathan, you had a chance to listen to the interview. What was your impression?
Well, it was fascinating, Keith. It was really a great opportunity to hear Liberace in candid conversation with very intelligent questions that, you know, give him sort of a stage to talk about what he likes to do and what his focuses are in his everyday life.
You know, what I find quite interesting and something that I've said to people before, I mean, I was lucky enough to see Liberace perform live in Montreal way back in the early 1980s at the Place des Arts. I think it was The Place des Arts. It may have been another location. And something that I always felt is that I think he was, by a lot of people, probably considered sort of underrated. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, especially at that point in his career. By the early 1980s, many orchestras had started to realize that behind the candelabra and behind the rhinestones was an actual virtuoso. And so he began to receive invitations to play with several orchestras and renowned conductors at incredible venues. Mm-hmm. And he very much enjoyed the notoriety in that and the recognition for the fact that he actually was, yes, a musician before he was a showman.
Do you think that if he would have lived a lot longer, that would have been one career of the concert pianist that would have taken off, that maybe the showman side would have been for one audience, but the concert pianist would have been for another audience?
I don't think so. I think it was the reverse. Liberace was the concert pianist before he was the showman. When he was 19, he was the youngest ever soloist for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The conductor, then a 65-year-old veteran, had later told the story about Liberace coming in the day he was to play the first concert and plopping down on a couch backstage and picking up a magazine. And the conductor basically saying, you know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, shouldn't you be practicing, Junior? And Liberace famously saying to him, oh, I wouldn't dream of coming if I wasn't prepared. And the conductor later saying that there was no way he could have known at the time, but Liberace was one of the most prepared musicians in American history. He was to play the Liszt Concerto in A major, 67 pages of music, that the conductor said later that he was 67 pages of music he did not need. He literally could play it backwards and forwards. He knew instinctively and by endless rehearsal how, when to lead the orchestra in, when to let them fade out. You know, he brought down the house that night. He was 19, and it bored him. When he left the concert venue one of those nights and during that stretch, he told the story of coming out of the stage door, coming around front, and after the crowd had been roaring for him, they walked right past him, and nobody knew who he was. He knew at that moment he wanted to put on a show, not just be a concert pianist, which he saw as much more limiting. So at a very early age, remembering that he was a prodigy and discovered at 5 years old by Paderewski, at a very early age, he had already delved into that whole arena and decided it was not for him.
A number of years ago, a colleague of mine who's at the BBC, by the name of Tony Myatt, he said he was a fan of Liberace, and he said that to me, that Liberace brought classical music to people that normally wouldn't listen to classical music by taking all the boring bits out.
That is a quote of Liberace. He used to say, "I play the classics with all the boring parts cut out." And you know, of course, the what's often forgotten with Liberace when we remember him is the humor, which was omnipresent in every conversation and every act. But I have heard the same and similar observations from people far more qualified than I in the arena of classical music and concert pianists in particular. I know of two Juilliard professors who give talks on Liberace. One of them orchestrates even the concerts that travel about with the about in the embassies in Washington, D.C. And he's a very serious concert pianist who told me that, you know, without Liberace, there wouldn't be pianos in middle American households. Mm-hmm. And it would not have been the instrument that, you know, you were supposed to play. He brought it to middle America, and otherwise it would have been only for the upper classes. And also he told me that the realm of the concert pianist fell for the rhinestones of Liberace just as much as everybody else, and didn't see what was going on behind that. And now they watch his arrangements, and this gentleman told me, this professor told me, I still can't figure out what he's doing with his left hand. So it's a it's a really interesting thing when they revisit it now. And there are these arrangements by Liberace and by his various conductors, including Bo Ayers, who's still on our advisory board today, who was Liberace's last conductor for the last 13 years of his touring. And there is this recognition now of the arrangements being quite brilliant. And there's the desire to study those. Ironically, of all of the things that we have in the Liberace Museum collection, we have trunk after trunk of handwritten arrangements by Liberace and by others who worked for him and with him, and others that he acquired over the years that are very old as 200 years old. And those have never been fully cataloged, curated, and made available. And so that's a project we hope to do in the future as we raise funds.
The other extraordinary thing before we actually talk about the foundation was the pianos that he performed with and traveling all around the world. Did he bring pianos with him, or did he have specially made pianos and wherever he was performing?
Early on, the answer to that is both. I would say more often than not, he brought pianos with him. But there are certainly circumstances where, when they knew he was coming, somebody would take advantage of the idea and build a piano or offer up a piano for him to play at their location, and then leave it afterwards as a sort of an iconic artifact. Mm-hmm. That was true at one venue in Texas, and there's probably others like that. But he was a Baldwin artist, so he did have some obligation to play most of his career on Baldwin pianos. And Baldwin did provide those pianos and travel them for him. So in most cases, that was the situation. It was not the case when he played in Monaco, where he played an antique box piano in which he had secretly inserted Steinway guts. Mm-hmm. So, but he had, and it wasn't true in a few other places too, but by and large, he would play his own Baldwin pianos when he traveled.
Right. You know, when I've watched clips of concerts and the one that I went to see, I mean, he was always, of course, trying to reinvent himself in the performance to make, you know, one tour very different from the other. And it got me thinking, with today's technology, I could just see him taking drone technology, attaching drones to a piano, and then flying the piano over the audience.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. I think you see some of that. Some of the stars who have credited that kind of thinking in their showmanship to Liberace include Lady Gaga, who, if there's anybody who's come close to what you're talking to, it's Lady Gaga, and also a few years back, CeeLo Green,
right,
who had a piano rotate on a stage. And CeeLo, of course, did a show in Liberace called Liberace. And I happened to meet him then. We licensed that show, and I happened to meet him then, and he told me that it wasn't just a gimmick, that Liberace was the reason he got into the business. And that queued up an investigation by me. I was really curious then to see how many other artists had that sort of feeling about Liberace's work and the relationship to the showmanship, that he developed. And I found it to be extraordinary. But according to Genius.com, he's mentioned in the lyrics of 2,600 songs. They range from, you know, the Cordettes in 1950 singing Mr. Sandman to 1955 to hip hop artist Rick Ross doing an album called Geechee Liberace last year, a reggaeton artist a few months ago doing an album called Liberace, in which he recreates the Liberace rings on his fingers on the cover. It's just all the way from Tim McGraw mentions him in lyrics to Lady Gaga to Tupac Shakur to Dr. Dre. It's just amazing. It crosses all genres and it spans generations.
There's an interesting version of the song "Let's Do It" that Noel Coward covers, and he also mentions Liberace in the song. The line is, even Liberace, we assume, does it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
That's right. You know, I remember that. That's a great little bit of humor in the line as well, a little tongue-in-cheek for Liberace's friends there. Mm-hmm. You find more and more of that as you investigate, and it tends to be these days a lot of the showing your chops when you mention Liberace in your lyrics as a recording artist. And
right.
So there's a lot of that.
Let's talk about the Liberace Foundation. When was the foundation set up?
Well, I'll tell you. I came onto the foundation board in 2012, and I was recruited to it when it was basically trying to figure out how to get some money in the door and what to do next. By then the museum had been closed for a couple of years. The Liberace Museum had closed in 2010. The endowment fund had been exhausted, they're trying to decide how to go forward. Now, at first blush, this was confusing to me because I was also under the impression from the various rumors and sometimes what the press puts out and sometimes what board members of the Liberace Foundation itself had said, I was under the impression that it had been endowed with a tremendous amount of money. The rumors were that he originally endowed it with $88 million and was worth about $110 million when he died. So that would be an extraordinary amount of money. Well, I soon found out after 2014 when I took over as chairman of the board, I soon found out that we did have all of those financial records, every single financial statement going back for every year. And I soon found out that the endowment was never anywhere near that, but that was all part of the show. The endowment was actually about $8.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
And move a decimal over, you know. And most of that was the artifacts for the collection. It was about $4 million or close to $4 million in cash.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that time, from that endowment in 1987 at the death of Liberace, the foundation began, from that day, it gave away over $6 million in scholarships and grants between then and 2010, or 2011. So that's not including a couple of endowment funds that remain at universities today in Liberace's name and continue to gain interest, and they, of course, make their scholarships from interest. So it was a successful run when you backtrack. I mean, if you take an endowment that had about $4 million in cash and then this collection, and they managed to not only pay all the bills but give away $6 million over the next 30 years and then sunset the fund, that's not so bad. So the first thing I had to do is dispel the myth that somebody stole $80 million. It was never there.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, it's what do we do from here? The museum model was no longer really viable. While there's people miss it and they would love to see it again, few people actually pay, buy tickets, and come to a attraction of that nature anymore. In Las Vegas and in similar markets. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say few people, but relative to the previous record, it would have been, it's not sustainable. It could be very sustainable for others. I'm not knocking the model in general, but as far as the Liberace Foundation goes, I could see in retrospect why they did close the museum. That was one of the reasons. There were other reasons too.
Right. But the thing is, like you just said, this kind of museum doesn't attract the same amount of people that it would have, like say 20 years ago.
Exactly. So as a model, for producing income, it just doesn't. It's not going to do what we need to do. If we're going to rebuild an endowment fund, which is ultimately the objective, then we have to have a different business plan. And so, a couple of years ago, I went to work very hard on figuring out what that business plan would be, and it is what I suspected at the time that I signed onto the board, and that is brand licensing of Liberace. The real genius of Liberace. Well, there's a lot of different aspects of this, but he recognized that his foundation should be a one-stop shop for anybody that wanted to know about him, learn from what he did, or be able to utilize his trademarks, brands, imagery, and name. And so he left all of that to his foundation. So It is the foundation that's the one-stop shop for everything Liberace, and makes it very easy to license in that regard, unlike many other estates where you have to deal with several family members and various different things that make it very arduous.
Right.
So in that regard, it would have been very easy to do all along, but nobody did it. So there wasn't much licensing of Liberace, very little, since his death, and consequently the brand was never developed. So that now is our project, is to develop the brand. We're bringing in some big guns to help us do that, and to make it so that the foundation can take in some income immediately, and also be have a much more valuable brand estate that will indefinitely replenish the endowment funds.
Right.
So that's our model going forward.
Because other artists, well-known artists who are no longer with us, like for example Frank Sinatra, there's still the Frank Sinatra brand, which is quite powerful.
Absolutely, and it's also very well protected.
Mm-hmm.
It's worth pointing out that it sounds easy to go license an old a legacy star who's no longer with us. It sounds easy to go license their name and go to work on it. But the reality is, if you start doing it, then you also have to spend the money to protect it when people infringe on that brand.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you lose it. Then it becomes public domain. So it's very touchy, and Sinatra has been very well protected by that estate. In Las Vegas, the only licensed restaurant that is at the Wynn Sinatra's, for example, in a well-known place. And so, yes, that's a good example of that. Also, the other big Las Vegas-related brand that is similar is, of course, Elvis.
Right.
Both of these guys were friends of Liberace. The Elvis estate, sold in majority stake by Lisa Marie Presley years ago for hundreds of millions of dollars. She sold 85% of it, and she knew what she was doing. She had done her homework, and it's worked out quite well. Now now that brand is held by Authentic Brands Group and is progressing. So it's an interesting developing business over the past few years, and it's certainly the new model for monetizing any sort of a legacy brand like this, a legacy performer or personality.
Right. Something actually that is quite interesting about Sinatra's estate is, I mean, he recorded so many albums for Columbia, Capitol, and Reprise. What is interesting actually is the estate, because many of all these albums have been released either on CD or have been reissued on vinyl. And the agreement now, because all the recordings belong to the estate themselves, is that, okay, you can release it, but you have to release it in the original order that it was originally done.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that is a fascinating.
You know, because the thing is, Sinatra, like a lot of other artists, they had concept records, so you can have an album by Sinatra or even Elvis. The album had each song, and the way it was placed was for a reason. You know,
right?
So
the argument being that the album itself is an arrangement.
Yes,
it's an interesting approach.
Yeah. Now, with the Liberace Foundation, are there any plans to exhibit some of his items in the future?
Yeah, well, we presently, to give you an idea of where we were, at the beginning of 2014, when I took over as chairman, we were in a Chapter 11. We had about $1.5 million in mortgage debt, about another $300,000 in non-mortgage debt. We had virtually no income and no paying exhibits. We mm-hmm. had no brand licensing. We had almost no prospects of any income, and we were down to less than six figures in the bank, or right at about $100,000 in the bank. So we had expenses in the $300,000 range annually, overhead in the $300,000 range, most of it in storage. So we had to go to work to really get things moved around, and we're out of the Chapter 11 now, and the collection, which takes up a tremendous amount of space and requires air conditioning and so forth, is now placed at three different locations that are all donated space,
mm-hmm.
and the foundation does not pay any rent or utilities at all, and it has no salaries, only a few hourly employees. So it's very much cut down in its expenses and so forth, and none of the board takes any money for what they do. So it took us a couple of years to get to zero, and that's where we are now, about to launch into the brand licensing scenarios. As far as the exhibits go, thankfully, two of the spaces, or actually all three of the spaces where we have our collection on storage, is also visible. And the first I would mention is our space that's open to the public, which is Liberace Garage. Liberace Garage is a part of the Hollywood Cars Museum mm-hmm. in Las Vegas, a facility owned by real estate developer Michael Deser. And Deser donated to us the 5,000 square feet that we have for Liberace's stage cars. And we have that space was designed by Las Vegas designer Paulina Big Sparkle, who made it look like Liberace's garage. She's got his chandeliers hanging in there in the shiny black floor, and it's an event space as well, with the stage from the old museum space, the stage and one of his pianos on stage and so forth. So it's a great space to see the cars that he had on stage. Of course, he was one of the first to bring cars on stage, and it became part of his sort of trademark.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the Liberace Museum store is also there. So that's the first space in Las Vegas on Dean Martin Drive. The other is that we have donated space inside the former home of Michael Jackson in Las Vegas, which is called the place known as Thriller Villa, and that property is a very large home with a gigantic underground vaulting system that was used to stash artwork by Michael Jackson and by the builder of the home before him.
Right.
And so the owner of it donated the underground space to us and to be able to house the Liberace Museum collection. We're able to house most of it there, especially that's where we have all of the costumes. And we're also able to have about a 3,500 square foot exhibit there of costumes and furniture and so forth that were items from his mansions and whatnot. So it's a great exhibit that we call Liberace at Thriller Villa, Showmanship and the Man in the Mirror. That's not open to the public, but we are able to bring in people one by one on a private tour basis.
Right.
And so we do that as well.
Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us today. We'll give out the email address at the end of the program. To play us out, let's take a listen to... Well, actually, it's one of my favorite Liberace arrangements. It's the Boogie Woogie. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
that part again so you can all shout hey, okay? Want to do it again, don't you? Hey! How about the ladies doing it all by themselves, okay? Okay, fellas, now it's your turn. Hey! You see, there are men in my audiences, too. I hope I didn't leave anybody out. Well, you never know when Tiny Tim might be in the audience. Now, this boogie-woogie I've been playing for you is a kind that is known as boogie-woogie 8 to the bar. Here's a little invention of my own, boogie-woogie 16 to the bar.
Boogie Woogie, Liberace, playing at 16/8 of the bar. And before that, I was speaking to Jonathan Warren from the Liberace Foundation for the Creative and Performing Arts. You can find them online at liberace.org. Do go and check them out. It's a fascinating, fascinating website. In 1981, Tom Meyer spoke to Liberace when he was on a European tour at the Amsterdam Hilton.
How come that somebody who's been in the business for quite a while took so long to come to Amsterdam?
I keep asking myself that because the tour so far, which has taken me to Stockholm and Oslo and Copenhagen and Hamburg, has been fantastic. The response has been so marvelous, and it's almost like the people were waiting for me to come, you know? And I wonder why I waited so long. I think I was worried that there would be a language barrier. Mm-hmm. But I've discovered that most of the people in my audience are bilingual, and those who aren't enjoy the music and the costumes and the spectacle of the show. And every one of those places I've been to, they've all asked me to come back, which is, of course,
good.
A wonderful compliment. And they want me to stay longer because this is a fast tour. I'm spending about 2, possibly 3 days in each city, which isn't very long. And so it's more or less a preliminary tour of what I hope to do more of in the future.
Uh-huh. You're casing the joint and then you're finding out where you want to go back.
Well, you know, I didn't want to take any chances by overstaying the first time around because I realized that I'm new to a lot of people. Some of the people, of course, have seen me on television or in pictures, but never in person. And it's a big difference to see somebody in person. I've always felt that nothing would take the place of a live performance. And I was reading a marvelous article in one of the news magazines where so many people who are public figures are now being seen on television by the public, but they're not satisfied to see them that way. They want to see them up close, and they want to touch them and mm-hmm. shake their hand. And that's not only for entertainment figures, but people in the political world and the celebrities mm-hmm. of all types, you know.
But doesn't it work the other way around, too, for someone who is, let's say, on stage? It must be far more fulfilling to be on a real live stage with a real live audience than just have the cameras and the lights on you.
Oh, there's nothing to take the place of a live audience. That's the real pure form of show business. And I feel sorry for some of the people in our industry who don't get the opportunity to perform before a live audience. A good example I can give you is that at the age of 49, Elizabeth Taylor is making her first stage appearance before a live audience in New York in the play The Little Foxes. And here's a fabulous lady who has won Academy Awards and has certainly been one of the legendary people in the motion picture industry, for the first time now is performing live mm-hmm. before an audience. And it's magic, you know, to have that opportunity. I've been very fortunate to have played before live audiences since I was 13 years old. And so it's still a thrill. It's still a thrill to come before an audience. Everyone is different. Everyone is new and fresh. And it's a challenge. And particularly now in Europe to have no idea what to expect is a thrill.
You really didn't have any idea? I mean, there was no research done or whatever?
Oh, yes. The only thing I had to go by was when they first approached me about coming to Europe, I said, who's gone before me? And they dropped a few names that mm-hmm. I knew, like Sinatra and Liza mm-hmm. Minnelli and Sammy Davis. And I was assured that they were very successful. Mm-hmm. The people loved the fact that they came to their country and perform for them. And so that's really all I had to go on.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any idea yourself, not having been here, at least not having worked here, did you have any idea of what certain people would be like? I know that the Dutch have a certain image abroad, like almost every nationality has. Did you have any idea, well, the Dutch are going to react this way, or the Norwegians are going to react a different way, or the Germans, or?
Well, I was told, first of all, that in the Scandinavian countries, I would have no language difficulty at all, that everybody spoke English. In Amsterdam, the thing that intrigued me so about Amsterdam is that I understand that it's a sort of a melting pot of cultures of all countries and nationalities, and everybody goes about doing their own thing without creating any problems. Yeah. And their slogan in Amsterdam is one that I live by and love, live and let live.
Right, yes.
And I think that's a marvelous reputation or image mm-hmm. for a city like Amsterdam to have. So,
are you looking forward to the show tonight?
Oh, yes. And, of course, the concert hall. I haven't ever seen one more beautiful. Mm, really. I can't wait to walk down those famous steps.
I can just
in
see
the
you
fur
do.
Coat.
Right. I will see you do
oh,
it.
Great.
You picked a warm day in Amsterdam to walk down those steps in the fur coat.
I create my own seasons on the stage.
Right.
And, you know, in Las Vegas, for instance, when I play there in the summer, it could be 120 degrees outside. But inside, it's always cool.
Right. Yeah. Now, you brought up the fur coat and, of course, everything else that goes with it, known by the people who know you, who've seen you, maybe just on television. And that's something I've been wondering about. An image like yours, okay, you're advertised as Mr. Showmanship, whatever the people use, you could say you were the very first Mr. Glitter in international show business. And people sometimes wonder, is an image like this, an image that you acquired a long time ago, something that's carefully planned by yourself or maybe by somebody else, or is it something that gradually develops and that sort of accidentally happens?
That's exactly how it happened, accidentally. But after it happened accidentally, then, of course, it was carefully planned because mm-hmm. I realized that each time around, I had to top myself. I had to be
more extravagant.
More extravagant. And the fact that other performers began copying my way of dress on the stage, I had to be a few steps ahead all the time. Mm-hmm. And my costumes have become an expensive joke because I do play them for humor, and I laugh at myself before the audience has a chance to laugh at me.
Uh-huh.
And so we laugh together, which is a very healthy kind of thing to have in a show. And my first departure from what was considered the normal way of stage attire was going from black to white.
Mm-hmm.
And back in 1952, when I did that at the Hollywood Bowl, that was considered very daring.
Mm.
And, of course, then I went from white to gold and from gold to sparkles and from sparkles to diamonds and diamonds to furs and all of that. It just snowballed and has become a very expected part of my performance. And there was a time when I got a little disenchanted, let's say, with all of this because it was a very expensive thing. And I let people around me who were close to me talk me in and say, you know, you could save a lot of money if you just went out on the stage and played the piano and forgot about all that nonsense and all that jazz, you know. And I let somebody talk me into it. In 1958, I did a television series, and I went very... very plain, very plain. I wore Brooks Brothers suits, very plain. And it was, frankly, a disaster.
Oh, really?
People wrote in by the thousands saying how disappointed they were that I didn't wear my costumes and didn't have the candelabra, which became such a trademark of mine. I fulfilled my contract on the television show, and in each of the programs, after I started getting the public reaction, I told them that I was going to return to mm-hmm. my former
yeah.
self, and it worked. You know, I went back, I did a tour after that, and of course, everybody was curious to see what I was going
yeah.
to do, and it was... better the second time around than the first.
But I could imagine that it could be disheartening when you discover that the emphasis on the image, and in your case on the costumes and the glitter, haven't you ever felt that it meant a sort of a underestimation of what you really are, your art as a pianist?
Well, actually, it was a combination of both. After the window dressing and after the showmanship, then you have to sit down and perform.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of the two is something that was magic, and it worked for me so beautifully and so successfully that it was really wrong for me to try to eliminate mm-hmm. one or the other. In other words, I never relied strictly on showmanship, and I never relied strictly on musicianship. But the combination of the two worked for me. And in recent years, I have been winning some very important awards for my musicianship, mm-hmm. my piano playing. And for 3 years in a row, I've been voted the most popular pianist in America. And I've made the Guinness Book of World Records twice.
What record?
Well, I'm in one part of the Guinness Book, I'm listed as the highest paid musician in the world.
Well, well.
And in another section of Guinness, I am listed as the fastest piano player in the world.
The fastest.
The fastest. And I'm being recognized now on my musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been happening now for about the past 10 years. And I'm getting invitations now to play with symphony orchestras and things like that, because conductors of symphony orchestras have come to realize that my appearance with their orchestra could, in many instances, take them out of the red. So many of the symphonies around the country, especially in my country, are suffering from lack of funds and so forth, and they're beginning to bring popular artists like myself and Victor Borg and playing with the symphony orchestras to bring the average non-concert going public into the symphony's programs, and I think it's a very good thing. There's several conductors around the country that have a very modern attitude about the programs that they're presenting, and they're trying to make the programs more appealing to the average listener, not necessarily the musical purist mm-hmm. kind of audience, but college students.
Right.
And in Los Angeles, they performed an experiment that was very successful. They invited all the school children to the rehearsals of the symphony orchestras, of the Philharmonic, and the children were absolutely fascinated by the fact that there are other instruments in music than drums, guitars and electric keyboards, you know,
yeah,
which
well.
That's the only kind they listen to
right.
in rock and roll, you know.
So it helped them to cross a threshold which otherwise probably they never would have crossed in their lives.
That's true. And Andre Previn,
mm-hmm.
I have to mention him because he's done so many marvelous things. In London, when he was guest conductor for several seasons of the Philharmonic, he had them take out all the seats in the concert hall and invited the college students in, and they sat on the carpeted floors and listened to the programs. And because of his background with motion pictures and everything, he would sit down after performing very classical music and extemporaneously play jazz and things like that. And the kids just adored it.
Yeah.
And but he got them into the concert halls that way. And I think it's a very healthy kind of thing to bring good music to a young audience that otherwise, you know, wouldn't hear it.
Yeah, so apart from being a showman and an artist, you've now also become an educator.
Well, I'm very involved particularly the university aspect of music. I fund, through my museum, 5 universities in the United States through my museum in Las Vegas. And the scholarships are given annually to worthy students in 5 of these universities, selected by the faculty and funded by the Liberace Foundation. And so I feel very good about sponsoring this kind of a program. Prior to that, people used to come to me and want to audition for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, I'll gladly hear you play, but I don't know what I can do for you,
yeah.
you know. And there's only a limited number of people that I can introduce in my shows. I use guest artists in my programs and on television. But that's just a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
But through the universities now, I can stimulate interest in music with thousands of students
mm-hmm.
instead of just a handful.
Right. Yeah. When you were talking about your museum in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
what kind of a museum is that?
Well, it's a museum devoted to all the memorabilia of my life and my career, and it's collections of things that I've lived with and things that have been given to me. And I'm a great collector. I save everything. So I finally have a place now where I can display all these things. And they're quite interesting in that it's such a varied kind of a collection. Mm-hmm. I have automobiles, pianos. I have a piano that belonged to Chopin, one that belonged to George Gershwin, and several pianos that have been donated to the museum that are historical. I have a piano that belonged to Abraham Lincoln. And
so if people think that all they're going to see in the museum is the gold and the glitter and the candelabras, they're wrong.
No, they'll also see that.
Yeah, of course.
I have about 1,000 costumes on display, some on mannequins and some displayed in glass cases, mm-hmm. and things. And then some of the cars that I've used on stage for various musical vignettes.
Yeah.
And I have some marvelous things that have been given to me, mm-hmm. by wonderful artists in show business. I have an Elvis Presley corner, uh-huh, of all, yeah. the Elvis Presley memorabilia. And when I did the Muppets show, I have all kinds of Muppet figures and yeah. Kermit playing the piano, right. and all those different, yeah. things that kids like. So it's a museum that caters to a family entertainment. There are very few things in Las Vegas that you can take kids to.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
Most of the shows have a sign outside the showroom door saying no one under 18 admitted because of the nudity and
right.
Some of the language that's used in shows.
Let's face it, under 18, they're not going to spend a lot of money in the...
well, I mean, they're not even allowed with their parents.
Right,
you know.
Yeah.
So...
I can imagine, but at least you've done something for that age group.
And yeah, and my show, and there's a few shows where families can bring their children.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Newton and mm-hmm. myself and Frank Sinatra... and Liza Minnelli,
yeah.
but most of the others are
out of bounds.
Yeah.
One last little thing. If you could organize a dinner party and invite, let's say, kindred souls, kindred spirits, which composers, let's limit them to four, which four composers would you invite at your dinner table?
Well, if it would be possible, I'd like to invite some of the old masters, because mm-hmm. I think they would be the most fascinating. All our music is founded on their writings and their teachings. And I would like to have Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to have Chopin. And I'd like to have George Gershwin. And I would like to have one of the Beatles, like Paul McCartney. I think that would just about cover the whole spectrum.
Good. We'll do that for you, only on the show, of course, because we can't organize the dinner party for you. I wish you, as we say in Dutch showbiz, toy, toy, toy tonight, which means good luck, but I'm sure that it's superfluous. You'll have it without our wishing you this success. Come back soon.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Tom Meyer and Liberace. And with that, we've come to the end of the show. I mean, we've really come to the end of the show. Like I said, it was a little bit tight today, but if you want to hear the full unedited interview that we did with Jonathan Warren, we will be uploading it at our website. We only had to shorten it because of time today, but you can catch the full-length interview on our website in a couple of days. So, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara, and we're going to have Liberace bidding you all farewell.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces. all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well, I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day. I'll be seeing you in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.